The headlines: Russia launches dozens of missile strikes across Ukraine, including on the capital, Kiev, as Ukrainian forces intensify shelling of eastern regions. The U.S. Senate passes a record $858 billion annual military spending bill that includes aid to Taiwan and Ukraine. And official data show that British consumers have cut down on buying goods as the country's cost of living crisis deepens. Hello and welcome, everybody. Here in the Iranian capital, Tehran, this is World News. Ukraine says it has shot down the majority of missiles fired by Russia in the latest flurry of such attacks. The chief commander of Ukraine's armed forces says 60 out of 76 Russian missiles were intercepted and destroyed. In southern Ukraine, two people lost their lives after a Russian rocket hit a residential building in Kryvyi Rih City. Meanwhile, in the Russian-controlled eastern Luhansk region, Ukrainian shelling of a village has killed at least 11 people and wounded around 20 others. That's according to pro-Russia forces who called the attack barbaric. Moscow and Kiev have stepped up their attacks against each other's positions in recent weeks. Ukraine says the Russian attacks have heavily damaged its energy infrastructure, causing widespread water and power cuts. Well, the U.S. Senate has passed next year's defense bill that authorizes a record $858 billion in annual defense spending. Senators passed the bill after it was approved by the House last week. It will now go to President Joe Biden to be signed into law. The bill includes a 4.6% pay rise for service members. It authorizes funding for purchases of weapons, ships, and aircraft. The bill also provides Ukraine with additional security assistance in its war with Russia and allocates more aid to Taiwan, whose ties remain tense with China. U.S. senators backed the bill by an overwhelming 83-11 bipartisan majority. The no votes came from a mix of liberals and fiscal conservatives. The liberals are opposed to the ever-rising military budget. The other group wants tighter controls on spending. Earlier, political analyst Markus Papadopoulos told us how the U.S. plan to adopt the largest military budget in its history is an attempt to shore up its embattled supremacy globally.
That the American government is to adopt the largest defense budget in U.S. history, namely $858 billion, at a time when American national debt stands at an astronomical $31 trillion, is indicative of the desperate and parlous condition that the American empire finds itself in. Because firstly, in international terms, the American government looks with great anxiety at the emergence of a multipolar world in which major economic powers in the world, such as Russia, China, and India, are dispensing with the dollar in their trade dealings with one another. And secondly, at home, there are major stirrings of anger all across America at the increasing levels of poverty. There are 44 million Americans living below the breadline. And in short, the adoption of a defense budget, which is the largest in US history, is an attempt by Washington to shore up its supremacy internationally and to shore up its control at home.
Well, turning now to the UK, where consumers have cut down on buying goods as the country's cost of living crisis deepens. According to the Office for National Statistics, retail sales by volume fell 0.4% in November. The office has blamed that on weaker online shopping despite Black Friday. Economists say the drop indicates the pressure consumers are enduring due to the surging inflation. They forecast that retail sales would see another drop in December due to heavy snowfall. The UK is grappling with a record inflation rate of nearly 11%, driven by soaring food and energy prices. The rate is above the 2% target of the Bank of England, which has been forced to raise interest rates over the past 12 months. Rising gas and electricity prices continuing to fuel public anger in Europe. Thousands of people have staged a protest in the Belgian capital, Brussels, over pay and working conditions.
When you get home, you've got kids. You want to be warm. We shouldn't be making calculations about energy use. Plus, given how much it's gone up, it takes up a huge part of our salary before you even consider the petrol, taxes, the car, and the rent. If you add it all up, you have to choose. You travel, you heat the house, or you eat. It's not conceivable in 2022.
The government says it has no money, but we need to go after the excess profits of some companies, some multinationals, look at taxation and income from capital and so on and so on. There are lots of options. The government says there is no money, but when the banks had problems, or as we saw with COVID-19, it's always possible to dig out some money. There are options, there are solutions. Now it's time for them to get around the table and come up with solutions because they do exist.
The protest was organized by trade unions representing several public sector workers. While peaceful, the demonstration has hit public transport systems with reports of canceled flights and disrupted traffic. Belgium has not escaped the cost of living crisis that hit its fellow member states of the European Union in the wake of the war in Ukraine. The country's inflation rate stood at more than 10% last month. News review, where we look deeper into some of the top stories of the day. On this segment of the program, Britain's Defense Ministry says it will open a statutory inquiry into allegations that its special forces carried out dozens of extrajudicial killings in Afghanistan. The probe will look into misconduct of the British Armed Forces regarding deliberate detention operations in Afghanistan between 2010 and 2013. In July, a report by the BBC alleged that British soldiers had killed 54 Afghans in suspicious circumstances. It cited individuals from the Special Air Service who witnessed the killing of unarmed people during night raids. The findings also suggested that high-ranking officers were aware of the killings but failed to pass on evidence to a murder inquiry. The British military police have previously conducted several inquiries into allegations of misconduct by its forces in Afghanistan. Joining us on this edition of the News Review, we have Elijah Magnea, journalist and political analyst, joining us from Brussels. Also, we have Carol Varekin, contributor at the Schiller Institute, joining us from the French capital, Paris. Gentlemen, welcome to the program. Let's start off with Mr. Magnea. We just had the news that the British Defense Ministry says that it will open this inquiry into allegations that its special forces carried out dozens of extrajudicial killings in Afghanistan. Why now?
I think this is just a kind of a show-off, because we know since years by NATO itself that 57% of the casualties were civilian killed by NATO forces. And we also have from NATO the same announcement that they have killed more civilians than the Taliban. We also have seen the investigation run by the Australian Defense Ministry, when the Inspector General Paul Brereton said that there is a warrior culture in Afghanistan embraced by commanders, that they ask junior soldiers to kill a prisoner just to show that they have guts, and they go and slay an Afghani civilian in custody without any judgment or any tribunal. So there are dozens of civilians that were deliberately killed in custody, and we don't know if they were innocent or not innocent, but I'm sure when they are arrested and they are called as civilians, they are without any doubt civilians, because this is what the NATO forces are telling us. So this culture exists and existed among NATO forces and hasn't disappeared. So waking up by the British now and say they want to investigate a killing that has been done between the year 2000 and 2019, when the American forces decided to withdraw, and they left only last year a couple of years ago. And then why they were leaving, the Americans bombed a car with civilians and never apologized or never compensated.
Sure, Mr. Varakin in Paris, what are your thoughts about the questionable timing of this inquiry?
Well, my take is that it's somehow, I think it's kind of mise en scène. It's a kind of, one can say it's good news outside the fact that it should be done by an outside commission, you know, because the British military department, they have been completely complicit by these things. And it's not, if the people who done it themselves are doing their own investigation, that it's there are British commanders and commandos on the ground in Ukraine, which are probably doing exactly the same thing what they did in Afghanistan, because they're operating under a NATO command structure and an individual Anglo-American operation, even outside NATO, where there is such a sense of impunity, because European countries, Germany, France, have completely collapsed. There's no more. In Germany, at least, there are some peace movements. In France, there are none. In Great Britain, there is no peace movement. So all these people, if you operate even as an honest military, in war is something very dirty. And once you go into a legal framework, which is an illegal war, then, you know, the individual soldier degenerates and becomes a real criminal. He can go into real criminal acts, which are beyond our imagination. The last point is the increasing use of private military companies like Blackwater used to be. So there are many, many people we saw in Iraq, the killings. And then these people have a very high level access to very high level political power and get protected from the top. So this thing, what happened, Amnesty International brought it out in July. It's good there is an investigation, but it's only one micron of the entire problem we have to solve.
That's right. Mr. Magnea, the U.S. forces, of course, are shoulder deep in allegations of extrajudicial killings. The question here is, will there ever be accountability for the crimes that were committed in Afghanistan?
Well, one of the reasons why Julian Assange spent a life prison is because he has revealed the wrongdoing of the American forces in Iraq and other dossiers, and among these, the killing of journalists in Baghdad by the US helicopters. So we have seen so many reports by the US doing committing crime, because it's a criminal offense by the UK law, by the US law, by any European law, to hide these crimes. And what we understand is President Donald Trump has pardoned one of the officers of the special forces responsible for killing civilians. So basically, when you have soldiers throwing bombs inside homes without making sure who is in the house, and then realizing that they've killed civilians and entire families, and then reporting it or not reporting it, and then this story is coming out 5 or 6 or 10 years later, or even 15 years later, and then we hear the responsible saying, well, we're going to go do further inquiries, and we're going to hold these crimes accountable, but then we don't hear anything about what the army is doing and how they admitted that guilt of committing crimes, how there are criminal court investigation into these crimes.
Mr. Rakin, if you may, please elaborate on the issue of hypocrisy that Mr. Magnea just touched upon. He also counted out a number of countries, Syria, Iraq, in addition to Afghanistan, where such crimes have taken place.
Well, the hypocrisy is that we have a dying system, which is relying on colonial methods. These are the old British colonial methods, which is once, first of all, to divide people, to kill each other. And then if they have to go on the ground, they will do, because these are seen as, if you are a Frenchman or a British and you go into Africa or in the Middle East, you know, they're denying the existence of other countries as such, so they're only behaving like if they would be in some kind of part of their own colonial empire, where the laws are much less strict as they would be in their own capital. So it's also a cultural issue of if we talk about the multipolar world, you know, this means we have to recognize that other civilizations have long cultures and long histories, be it China, be it Afghanistan, be it Iran, be it Russia. These are not just countries. These are the expressions of decades-old cultures.
All right, thanks a lot, gentlemen. That's all the time we have for this segment of the program. Journalist and political analyst Elijah Magnier joining us from Brussels, and contributor at the Schiller Institute, Carol Varekian, joining us from the French capital, Paris. With that, it brings us to an end here on this edition of the News Review. But do stay tuned. There's plenty more to come here on. Elsewhere in Jordan, people have been staging sit-ins as activists call for more protests against fuel price rises that have added to a cost-of-living squeeze. The protesters are demanding cuts in diesel prices. Tensions have mounted in several cities in southern Jordan, in particular after sporadic strikes by truck drivers. Yesterday, riots in a southern city left one police officer dead. Authorities said the policeman was killed by a gunshot. When armed officers were trying to quell riots, the government has promised to examine truck strikers' demands. However, the government says it's already paid over $700 million to cap fuel prices this year and can't do much more without breaching an International Monetary Fund deal. And that brings us to an end here on this edition of World News. Do stay tuned, though. Bye.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish.
In the limelight.
Maybe this year is a messy Christmas for the British instead of a Merry Christmas, as strikes and protests have brought the country to a standstill. After COVID ruined the last two Christmases for the Brits, strikes by nurses, postal workers, and other staff will bring much of normal life to a halt for the festive season. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. Wall Street Journal wrote, "The UK is set to face some of the worst strikes in at least a decade, raising fears that a winter of discontent will hit the country as workers push for bigger pay raises amid double-digit inflation and a gloomy economic outlook. University professors, teachers, railway staff, and even security guards at the luxury department store Harrods have held strikes recently. Nurses for Britain's State Health Service are threatening their first ever strike on selected days near Christmas, and ambulance drivers have voted to walk out for the first time in 30 years. Passport control officials also announced a strike in December at several UK airports. Recently, some 115,000 staff at the Royal Mail walked off the job, the first of six strike days planned ahead of Christmas that will disrupt postal service across the UK. The labour strife underscores the challenge for governments across Europe as inflation hits its highest levels in decades, due in part to Russia-Ukraine conflict, which sent energy prices soaring and added to pressure from supply chain disruptions from the pandemic. Governments and companies say much of the inflationary impact should begin easing in coming months and warn that large pay increases could entrench inflation. Unions argue that workers face the cost of living crisis and can't afford to see their inflation-adjusted wages fall. The situation is particularly bad in the UK, which has Europe's second highest rate of inflation after Germany and is facing a recession that economists expect to last a year or possibly two. Disposable household income adjusted for inflation is set to fall 7% over the next two fiscal years, the biggest drop in records going back to the 1950s, according to the Office for Budget Responsibility, an independent budget watchdog. The UK also had the Group of Seven's third highest inflation rate after Germany and Italy in October, according to figures from the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development. For months, trade unions have been locked in the strong arm contest with employers and the British government as they look to boost wage offers that they say are well below the current 11.1% pace of inflation. Average pay growth for the UK private sector was 6.6% in July to September 2022, compared with 2.2% for the public sector, according to the UK's Office for National Statistics. The last thing workers want to do is take a strike action, but the government has left them with no choice, said Rachel Harrison, National Secretary of the GMB Union, one of the country's biggest unions, representing workers from sectors across the economy, including paramedics. Some unions estimate more than a million working days will be lost to strike action this year, potentially hitting levels not seen since the end of former Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher's term in power, which was marked with frequent clashes with labour unions. In the past, it was possible to get public opinion against the strikers. These days, there is much more public sympathy, says Richard Hyman, Professor of Industrial Relations at the London School of Economics, adding, "If the government wants to tough it out, things might get more serious." An Ipsos poll in November found that 59% of the British public support the nurses' strike. Mr. Hyman expects the strikes to be the biggest in at least two decades. So far, the UK government has tried to resist the union's calls for wages moving in line with inflation, saying the country's finances can't take the strain. Prime Minister Rishi Sunak has already announced spending cuts and tax increases as the government looks to eventually begin lowering its debt in the coming days. If the union leaders continue to be unreasonable, then it is my duty to take action to protect lives and livelihoods, said Mr. Sunak, recently adding that he was planning to introduce legislation to force a minimum level of service in public services. Ambulance drivers have said they would only respond to life or death emergencies, such as a heart attack or stroke, leaving the possibility that other incidents such as broken hips could leave patients waiting in pain. Negotiations are ongoing to try to avoid these strikes. Critics say the government hasn't done enough to try to avert the disruption. He should get around the table and resolve these issues, said Labour Party leader Keir Starmer. The industrial disputes are drawing comparisons to Britain's so-called winter of discontent in late 1970s, when the country was hit by mass shutdowns and rolling blackouts as workers pushed for better wages. Those comparisons are, for now at least, stretched. An estimated 11 million working days were lost in 1979, a time when trade union membership was almost twice what it is today, according to UK government statistics. Currently, around 6.4 million workers are members of a union in the UK. Still, the breadth of the current planned walkouts is on a level not seen in Britain for years. About 100,000 civil servants have voted to strike across different government departments. Thousands of British nurses will go on a strike on December 15th and 20th after the government refused to meet their pay demands, the Royal College of Nursing Unions said. More than 10,000 ambulance workers across England and Wales will strike on December 21st and December 28th in a dispute over pay and working conditions. Meanwhile, Euronews noted travellers will face significant disruption to their Christmas travel plans after UK Border Force officers voted to strike over the holiday period. The industrial action will see Border Force officials walk out on 8 days during the busy festive season, from December 23rd to Boxing Day and from December 28th to New Year's Eve. This mass strike, conducted by members of the Public and Commercial Services Union, will likely delay security checks, causing lengthy queues and knock-on disruptions. Larger airports, which endured severe disruptions over the summer, are likely to be worst impacted. Some ports could see problems during the festive period. Passport checks, Heathrow, Gatwick, Manchester, Glasgow, Cardiff, and Birmingham are likely to be among those affected badly, according to the PCS Union. According to Euronews, Heathrow is expected to be the worst hit. The airport needs to recruit and train up to 25,000 security cleared staff before the festive period, a task the airport has described as a huge logistical challenge. We are supporting, including establishing a recruitment task force to help fill vacancies. More than 10,000 flights carrying up to 2 million passengers are expected to arrive at the affected airports between December 23rd to 31st, according to aviation analytics company Cyrium. UK Immigration Minister Robert Jenrick said that the strikes were unjustifiable and would ruin the plans of thousands of families and businesses. While we are working closely with all UK ports and airports and have robust plans in place to minimise any delays if a strike action goes ahead, passengers should be prepared for their plans to be severely disrupted, he said in a statement.
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
يا أيها الذين آمنوا, O you who believe, استعينوا بالصبر والصلاة.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Today we listen to the speech of Hujjatul Islam Salim Yusuf Ali.
Within the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, there's always this emphasis on trying to up our game, trying to work harder, trying to like do with whatever resources we have, trying to do better with them. I'm reminded of this one story we have from our fourth Imam, Imam Sajjad alayhi salam. One time he was, you know, engaged in deep worship of Allah Ta'ala, sujood, Quran, dua. And after he had become tired, right, physically tired, he went and he opened some type of container he had in which he was storing those things which were precious to him. And in that there was a document, and he began to read this document. The hadith says that this document was a description of the ibadah of Amirul Mu'mineen alayhi salam. And when Imam Sajjad alayhi salam is reading this, afterwards he makes this comment that he sighs and he says that who is it that can have the worship of Amirul Mu'mineen? Here is Sayyidul Sajideen, the one who will be identified on the Day of Judgment according to hadith as Zainul Abideen. And here he's saying that who can have the worship of Amirul Mu'mineen? What is the point here? That even for someone like Imam Sajjad alayhi salam, he's always saying that, okay, this is where I am. How can I go to the next level? That one of the teachings we have from the Ahlul Bayt alayhim salam is regarding the concept of hope when it comes to our actions. Hope is something which is very important. And without hope, right, everything, all of our efforts would fail. It's been identified for us. Our Prophet has a hadith report for him. He says that if it hadn't been for hope, then nobody who plants seeds would even plant that seed. No mother would tend to her child, because a lot of what we do is depending on the system to take care of things for us. Right? Imagine those 9 months that a mother spends waiting for the delivery of her child, the mother and father. Right? They don't know what's happening inside. Maybe once in a while they get like a black and white picture of I don't know what, and it kind of may say something to the doctor. But for the most part, it's trusting in the system, right? There's something else going on here. There's someone else who's doing what he has to do here. And that's how it continues for the rest of our lives. Much of what we do is outside of our own control, including whatever it has to do with our own bodies. But brothers and sisters, there's a time when our reliance on the system can be something that blinds us, where we become content with a certain way of doing things and we forget about those laws which are in place. And that is something which is called tulul amal. When somebody has so much hope that hope becomes a means of deception. I'm going to talk about how that affects us practically. But first I want to share with you a story from the life of our Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam. There was one of his dear companions, somebody who was close to him, who one time news comes to the Prophet that he had made a significant purchase. It's a very ordinary day-to-day matter here, right? We can relate to this practically. He had made a purchase, but he had made a promise that he was going to pay for this purchase at a later date. And when the Prophet heard that, he was actually disappointed with him. And he made a comment. He said that person is tawilul amal. His hope is something which has gotten the better of him. Now, I want to make a comment here that, you know, oftentimes we do things like we take loans, right? We maybe, let's say, buy a home, right? And a lot of it's based on like what's going to happen in the future. And that's pretty much the system that we live in here. Nobody buys things just with cash, right? So we need to understand what is it that the Prophet was trying to say. And it's very important that we think about this and ponder upon it. The Prophet goes on to explain. He says that when it comes to myself, the Prophet says, I do not have any guarantee that when I close my eyes for a blink of an eye, that I'm going to open them up again. And that when I put some food in my mouth, that it's going to find its way into my digestive system. Even to that extent, I don't give myself a guarantee. And then he addresses those who are gathered there at that time, and he says that you should imagine yourselves among the mota, meaning that imagine yourself as if that you are basically gone from here, and then plan accordingly. Now, there's a wrong way of understanding this, which is that somebody, let's say, is, you know, has one foot in the grave, right? They're always thinking that, okay, you know, I have to be morbid and, you know, I can't do anything planning for the future. That's not right. But what the prophet is saying is that sometimes it can be the case that somebody becomes deceived. They're being careless. And that's what was the case when it came to the companion. Maybe he wasn't in the financial position to be able to pay it at that date. He was being almost like a type of gamble. He was being careless. Not that what he did was haram. He probably went through it with all the legal provisions. But he was being careless. Why? Because he wasn't looking at, you know, his financial situation. He wasn't looking at the fact that, well, time is passing. What happens if he's not, if let's say something were to happen to him, who's going to pay off that loan at that time? So on a practical level, when we're trying to, you know, make our actions more pure, trying to make decisions, trying to plan, one of the things that we can consider is that sometimes we're deceived by this sort of illusion that as if we're here forever. As if we have endless number of days to do what we need to do. And this can sometimes cause huge problems. I'll give you a very practical example. We see that overall in the society we're in, people are getting married later and later. They want to finish their education, not just that. Then they want to find a career, not just that. They want to become established in their career, sometimes not just that. They have certain career aspirations. And then only when they get to that aspiration, then they say, okay, I've done that, right? I've given all of it, and now I can start thinking about, you know, the family thing. And sometimes it can be like 40 years old or even beyond that. And that's something which we see the same trend being reflected among Muslims as well, right? In our community as well, that the age continues to go up and up. Now, the teachings of our faith say that what? That, you know, that which is sweetest is that when it's done, it's taken at the ripest time. When you have that type of vitality, when you have that energy, this is the time to be thinking about family building. When you can run around with your children, when you can be there with them, when you can resonate with what they're going through. This is the optimal time. Yes, if we want to ignore reality, we might say, no, I have plenty of time in the future. We'll look at it from a medical perspective. Right? What are the experts say in medicine? That the longer you delay, then there's a lot of complications and risks that can occur as well. Sometimes it comes up with our health, right? That we think that, okay, well, I might be enjoying good health right now, and so I don't need to take care of myself, right? I can just sort of, you know, slip away from those type of good habits, right? What happens is that that's being deceived by this hope that I have in something which is a falsehood. We know that what we do to our bodies, eventually we'll see the reaction of that. It might not come in our younger years, but it can be seen at later years. That type of lifestyle where I'll ignore my basic needs, you know, to achieve this sort of like thing, I need to burn my way through success as the way they define it to me, sometimes it can cause huge problems later on in my life. All of these would be classified as this concept of tulul amal. I've been deceived by that. The hope God gave me was there to encourage me to work hard, but within certain boundaries, while I keep in mind reality. A reality is that our death has been written for us. We have a maximum time period, which the Quran tells us, ajalun musamma. There is a time where all of us will die. Yes, it may be the case that certain acts that we do may give us more life, or certain acts we do that might actually subtract from our lives. But there is a maximum time in which after that, there's no more living. Same thing with aging. وَمَن نُعَمِّرْهُ نُنَكِّسْهُ فِي الْخَلْقِ Allah says in the Quran very clearly, whoever we give life to, we take away from their physical creation. And these are realities that we need to come to terms with.
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar. Our email address is englishradio@irib.ir.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
A new report finds that the U.S. War Department uses security cooperation programs for secret wars. In this regard, we have provided the views and attitudes of world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. Responsible statecraft wrote, U.S. military forces have been engaged in unauthorized hostilities in many more countries than the Pentagon has disclosed to Congress, let alone the public, according to a major new report released recently by New York University School of Law's Brennan Center for Justice. Afghanistan, Iraq, maybe Libya. If you ask the average American where the United States has been at war, in the past 2 decades, you would likely get this short list, according to the report, adding, Secret War, how the U.S. uses partnerships and proxy forces to wage war under the radar. But this list is wrong, off by at least 17 countries in which the United States has engaged in armed conflict through ground forces, proxy forces, or airstrikes. The report's author, Catherine Yan Ebright, wrote in the introduction, this proliferation of secret war is a relatively recent phenomenon, and it is undemocratic and dangerous. The conduct of undisclosed hostilities in unreported counties contravenes our constitutional design. It invites military escalation that is unforeseeable to the public, to Congress, and even to the diplomats charged with managing U.S. foreign relations. The 39-page report focuses on so-called security cooperation programs authorized by Congress pursuant to the 2001 Authorization for Use of Military Force, or AUMF, against certain terrorist groups. One such program, known as Section 127E, authorized the Defense Department to provide support to foreign forces, irregular forces, groups, or individuals engaged in supporting or facilitating authorized ongoing military operations by United States Special Operations Forces to combat terrorism. According to the report, that support has been broadly, or more accurately, too broadly interpreted by the Pentagon. In practice, it has enabled the U.S. military to develop and control proxy forces that fight on behalf of, and sometimes alongside U.S. forces, and to use armed force to defend its local partners against adversaries in what the Pentagon calls collective self-defense, regardless of whether those adversaries pose any threat to U.S. territory or persons, and in some cases, whether or not the adversaries have been officially designated as legitimate targets under the 2001 AUMF. In Somalia in 2016, for example, U.S. forces invoked collective self-defense to launch a strike against a rival militia of the Puntland Security Force, an elite brigade that had originally been recruited, trained, and equipped by the CIA and subsequently taken over by the Pentagon in 2011. Moreover, the Pentagon deployed the PSF, which was largely independent of the Somali government, to fight Al-Shabaab and IS of Somalia, sometimes alongside U.S. forces for several years before the executive branch designated Al-Shabaab as legitimate targets. It has never so designated the ISS. Similarly, in Cameroon, U.S. forces accompanying a partner force on an advise and assist mission ended up shooting and killing an adversary. The Pentagon has used a Section 127 program there to pursue leaders of Boko Haram, a terrorist group that has never been publicly identified as an associated force of Al-Qaeda, and thus a lawful target under the 2001 AUMF, according to the report. Congress rarely hears of these incidents because, according to the report, the Department of War insists they are too minor or episodic to raise to the level of hostilities that would trigger reporting requirements under the 1973 War Powers Resolution. The report, which relies on published work by investigative reporters, interviews with knowledgeable officials and congressional staff, official documents and records, as well as the author's legal analysis, identifies 13 countries with Section 127E programs in addition to Somalia and Cameroon. They include Afghanistan, Egypt, Iraq, Kenya, Lebanon, Libya, Mali, Mauritania, Nigeria, Syria, Tunisia, and Yemen. But it is stressed that the list is almost certainly not exhaustive. 50 countries, from Mexico to Peru, in the west to Indonesia and the Philippines, where U.S. forces are known to have taken part in combat operation in the east, and covering 22 countries in North and Sub-Saharan Africa alone, not to mention Ukraine, had Section 333 programs in place as of mid-2018, according to the report. Perhaps even more dangerous than the Section 127E counterterrorism programs, according to the report, are security cooperation programs undertaken pursuant to Section 1202 of the National Defense Authorization Act of 2018. Using language that mirrors Section 127E, that provision goes beyond the counterterrorism purposes of Section 1273E by authorizing support to partner forces engaged in supporting or facilitating irregular warfare operations by the United States Special Operations Forces. Irregular warfare is identified by DOD as competition, short of traditional armed conflict or all-out war. Pentagon officials have described Section 1202 as a highly useful tool for enabling irregular warfare operations. to deter and defeat revisionist powers and rogue regimes. They have also insisted that irregular warfare is likely to be increasingly relied on as the ODA begins to prioritize great power competition. Broadly speaking, the purpose of the Section 1202 authority is to take the Department Section 127E approach of creating and controlling partner forces and wield it against countries like North Korea, according to the report. Section 1202, in short, raises the same potential as 127E for hostilities that Congress has not authorized, but with far graver consequences because the enemy could be a powerful nuclear-armed state. Given the increased risks, simply repealing or reforming outdated and overstretched AUMFs is insufficient. The report includes Congress should repeal or reform Department of Defense Security Cooperation authorities. Until it does so, the nation will continue to be at war, without in some cases the consent or even knowledge of its people, it added.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1930 to 2030 UTC on the following frequencies. 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz for Europe, and 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz for Southern Africa. And FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird Eutelsat 3B and Iran Sat or Bat 5 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Role of arrogant powers, policies, and recent bitter events in Iran is obvious. This is the part of speech delivered by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, on October 3, 2022, during the joint graduation ceremony for the cadets studying in the academies of the Islamic Republic of Iran's armed forces. This ceremony was held in Imam Hassan al-Mushtaba alayhi salam University of Officer and Police Training. transits cannot be carried out without security. Production is not possible without security. Security is the substructure for all of these things. Well, armed organizations are the ones who provide this never-ending universal need of the country and the general public. This is something you should be proud of. The army, the IRGC, the law enforcement organization, and the besieged all provide security in different ways. A person who attacks a police station is attacking the security of the country. The one who attacks one of the bases of the besieged is attacking the security of the country. The one who ridicules the army or the IRGC in their statements or speeches is insulting the country's security. Weakening the organizations and the armed forces means weakening the security of the country. The result of weakening the police is strengthening the criminals.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
The police have a duty to stand up to the criminals and ensure the safety of the public. The person who attacks the police is actually leaving the police defenseless against criminals, thugs, thieves, and extortionists. A great advantage that our country has is that the security we have has been built from within. It makes a big difference when a country or a nation creates security from itself, from within, with its own forces, with its own power, and with its own thoughts and ideas, compared to a country that has a foreign power telling them that they will provide them with security and protection. This is like a person protecting his milking cow. These are two very different things. Our security has been built from within. We rely on no one for our security. We have succeeded in creating and maintaining this security with the strength that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has given us.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.